Donald, welcome to Easy Conversations. It's good to see you again, this time behind the camera, not in person. But generally, I find with my podcast guests, if I do end up meeting them, I meet them virtually first and then in person. But this was backwards, so it's good. And I think we connected. Basically, we were standing next to each other at the book fair at PodFest, and it turned out you happened to be from Fort Saskatchewan, a small town in Alberta, where I moved almost 20 years ago for work. So very small world when you think about it, that we were in Florida talking about Fort Saskatchewan. But what really also caught my eye was the books you had laid out, your books, and the topics you were talking about. And I felt immediately those topics resonated for me. And I think we barely scratched the surface. We've spoken on the phone a couple of times, but I'm really looking forward to exploring all these topics. But how does a man from Fort Saskatchewan get into these areas of spirituality and some of the things you're exploring in your books? How does that happen?
Yeah, of course. There's always a story. By the time you get this much white hair, it's a long story. So yeah, the place that we live or the place that we grow up has no bearing on whether we have an interest in spiritual things or not. That comes from our soul.
Yeah.
And yeah, the fact that I grew up in Fort Saskatchewan and my father, of course, we were there because my father had a job there, right? He worked for what at that time was called Sherritt Gordon Mines. And my father was a metallurgical engineer, worked in the metal side of the business, particularly in the rolling mill where they roll the nickel out into sheets that are then rolled up, and in coinage products. Most of his career was involved with the coinage products. So I grew up in Fort Saskatchewan. It's a great place to grow up. It was a small town then. We call these places cities in Alberta, and you get to be about 10 to 15,000 people, which is in some parts of the world still considered a village. But in Alberta, because you get more money from the provincial government if you're a city rather than a town, then there's a lot of financial incentive for any town to declare itself a city. So Fort Saskatchewan is officially a city now.
Yeah.
Probably 30,000 people or so, but it was about 3,000 or 4,000 people, 5,000 people maybe when I was growing up. So how do I get involved in spiritual things? Like I say, it comes from my soul, not from Fort Saskatchewan, but there was a number. And interestingly, I grew up in an atheist family. My parents confirmed atheists. They thought all of this religious stuff was all nonsense. Whole university educated in the sort of scientism that has been so rampant in academia in the last century, I'd say. Academia, what scientism wasn't rampant before a century ago. Universities started out being primarily focused on theology and training of priests and that sort of thing. But anyway, scientism is rampant, and most university-educated people don't realize, they don't delve into the philosophy of it, so they don't realize it's really an ideology. It's not science. Scientism is not science and really has no scientific basis, but you get this. So anyways, I grew up in an atheist household where it didn't matter. I could read anything. They didn't care. So I had an interest in spiritual stuff. It got sparked partly because I got involved in the band program and I loved music. And our band director throughout junior and senior high school was also worked part-time as a Protestant minister. Your whole worldview, everything about who you are comes through in your teaching as a teacher. It doesn't matter what you're teaching, because we teach really more by who we are and what we do than by what we say. And so that came through, and that kind of interested me. At band camp one summer, surprisingly enough, I ran into another student who was just turned on about Edgar Cayce. Edgar Cayce this, Edgar Cayce that, and all these. And he was focused on Atlantis and the physical changes in the world that he predicted and all that kind of stuff. Those things that capture people's attention. Oh, really? especially as a 13-year-old or whatever I was at that time, 14 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got kind of tied into Edgar Cayce at an early age and then started reading more about philosophy. I read Siddhartha, I think in high school, maybe even in junior high school, in high school by Hermann Hesse, which is a fictionalized account of the life of Siddhartha Gautama, was who we know as Buddha.
Right.
And so, yeah, I read the Bible. I've never read the whole Bible cover to cover. I tried to do that lots of times and then got bogged down in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy that are just not interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was always thrilled, more thrilled with the gospel. Like Jesus, ever since I was probably junior high school, my kind of focus has been more on Jesus than on kind of Christianity and Christian theology in a more general sense. Although after I got married, my wife had grew up Catholic, had left the Catholic Church, but then after we got married, she wanted to return to the Catholic Church. I was okay, fine with me. So I became Catholic and had been Catholic for four decades or more. Mm-hmm. So I had kind of had that background, but in my teenage years, it was very widely read about astrology, read philosophy, read Plato, and all kinds of stuff very broadly. And really,
yes,
I, on a spiritual level, my understanding thoughts more in that branch of Christianity that we would call mystic Christianity or esoteric Christianity, and more in the line of what has nowadays been called new thought, or the more common unity, most of it's kind of unity, unity churches, that sort of thing. So that's kind of how I got started in spirituality. But in a lot of esoteric, the esoteric traditions in Catholicism and Christianity, that's kind of where my focus has been over the last couple of decades. But anyway,
yes,
that's a rather longish answer to how does a guy from Fort Saskatchewan get interested in spiritual things?
So it sounds like you were interested in this stuff from the very early age, and you were obviously reading a lot about different spiritual practices or just even religion, more so focused, like you said, on Catholicism. But there was a pull that you were experiencing, and that continued and has continued. So you talked about all the gray hair. So what did you... At what point did you decide to write books about these things that you were uncovering and thinking about yourself?
I've come through several careers. So music has been my first love. I mentioned falling in love with music in junior and senior high school. I was really involved in our school band program and played. And clarinet's my principal instrument. So going through high school, like I played in provincial honor bands. I played in the Edmonton Youth Orchestra when I was in high school. Went on to the University of Toronto in a music performance program. But ended up deciding after a while that as much as I'd love music, at university, I got a little closer view of what the music business was really like and what the life of a musician was really like. And I decided that as much as I'd love music, I didn't want that life. I didn't want that lifestyle. And so I dropped out of music and did other things, ended up kind of going into working on business degree for a little while, working, doing various things. And then at one point I needed the job for a while. So I took a job at Sherrod, which is at that time was one company, but it had the metals division and the fertilizer division. And I ended up taking a job in the fertilizer division. One thing led to another, got married, bought a house, got a mortgage at Thunder Valley, and here I was kind of stuck. So I spent almost 20 years in the fertilizer industry, starting as a laborer and then moving into process operations. So I ended up getting a third class power engineering certificate, worked in our ammonia plant, our utilities plant, and then went back to university. Technically, I was a full-time student for 4 years at U of A while I was still working full-time shift work at the plant. So I ended up missing, I don't know, a third of my classes when I was on day shift. I'd try to go if I was on night shift or on days off. And finally graduated with a degree in economics. And with that, managed to stick my foot firmly in the door of the marketing department enough to get a job in fertilizer marketing, and then moved over into our fertilizer new products research group, where I worked for 5 years in a marketing capacity. It was a very small group. I was kind of the marketing person. So we had a chemist, a marketing person, et cetera.
Yes.
And so I worked on looking at that, taking our economic and business marketing evaluation of the projects mm-hmm. and products we were working on. We took two products during my tenure there to the point of test marketing and test production. And then in 1999, I got laid off. It's a restructuring, and the fertilizer industry has continued to restructure after that.
Yeah.
And so I decided I wanted to go back to my first love, which was music. And I went back into music education, became a band director, went back to university, got another degree in economics, and then spent almost two decades as a band director and in the field of music. And then 2019, I officially retired as a teacher and took up what I count now as my third career as an author and speaker, and primarily as a spiritual author. So my first book was a collection, or is a collection, of modern day parables inspired by events of my teaching. Little things that happen when you're working with kids, we often call them teachable moment. When something comes up and you think, guys, there's a bigger lesson happening right here than the alternate F sharp fingering on the clarinet that I was trying to teach here. And so I started writing some of those little stories down and turning them into parables, with so that the whole book is it's full of metaphors, and the whole book is actually a grand metaphor. And so there's each of the 50 parables in that book. It's called The Band Director's Lessons About Life. And it's a bit like a chicken soup for the soul book. There's 50 little parables. Each one's about 3 pages long, and each one starts out with a story that happened in school, and then a reflection section that draws a spiritual lesson out of the events of the story. In essence, explaining what the metaphor is. How, like, trying to play a high note on the flute. What's the spiritual meaning in there? So there's a parable about love, a parable about forgiveness, a parable about perseverance, a parable about being yourself, all these little things that there's spiritual lessons scattered through our daily lives. And so all I did was draw those out. And that was the beginning of what's now a 3-book series in what I call my band director series, where in all of those books, I use music as a metaphor for life. So there's the band director's lessons about life. And yes, that's me on the cover with my pre-COVID haircut, my clean-cut businessman look that I'd had for most of my life until they shut down everything in 2020, including the haircutting joints. And I was mad for about 2 weeks because I wanted to get my hair cut. And then I decided, hey, if they won't let me cut my hair, piss on them. I won't cut my hair until we get freedom back. Yeah, so it's still growing. The band director's lessons about life, that's the book of parables. And then actually the most recent book I've published is this one. It's a study guide that goes along with that book of parables. And it essentially turns the book of parables into a year-long course in spiritual development. So you spend a week on each of the 50 parables, and there's a little further lesson on the meaning of the parable. There's discussion and reflection questions, especially if you wanted to do it as a study group, and a meditation for each week to focus on that lesson, that spiritual lesson. And then I've also published this one, little one, The Band Director's Pocket Guide to Spiritual Growth, in which I've pulled together like 3 little steps that nobody really talks about spiritual growth in this way. And I thought, you know, I haven't found this anywhere else. I should write this down because it's not hard. As I often say, it's simple, but not easy. So that's why I say there are 3 simple steps, not 3 easy steps.
Yes, for sure.
So then, and so I published the first book in December of 2019. Now, that particular time might bring back some memories to you.
Yes, for a lot of people.
At the end of December 2019, we just started to hear these little murmurs coming out of China about this flu thing.
Yes.
And then, of course, in the next few months, that just blew up and the whole world shut down and totally turned my world upside down. I was going to tour around with this book and I was going to get into doing more public speaking. In fact, by March of 2020, I'd actually got a couple bookings as a speaker at conferences. Then before March was done, every conference had been canceled.
Yeah.
Like, so one of my big goals for 2020 was to start getting paid for public speaking. You couldn't even meet with more than 4 people at a time. Yeah, that was the end of public speaking. So many people, our lives got turned upside down.
Yes.
So then that drove me down the rabbit hole. So just to back up. So this is now my third career, right? I have two decades in the fertilizer industry, yep. 2 decades as a band director and teacher. Now I'm on my third career as what I thought of as a spiritual author and speaker. And now in 2020, I get drawn down the rabbit hole trying to figure out, what the hell is going on? This makes no sense. This is crazy.
Yeah.
It's like many people got dragged down the rabbit hole in 2020, trying to figure out what was going on. And that ultimately became the title of this big book, What the Hell's Going On?
Mm-hmm.
The web of fraud that is enslaving everyone and how we can escape to freedom. Mm-hmm. So by the end of 2020, I had put together at least some of the pieces. And I had, by that time, I'd realized, you know what? I hear people talking and writing about different aspects of what's going on, but nobody seems to have put it together the way I've put it together.
Mm.
I thought, well, you call yourself an author. I guess you better write about it.
Mm.
So one of the things that's really different about what the hell's going on is I look at what's going on also from a spiritual perspective.
Mm.
And not many people do that.
Right.
So there are lots of frauds. I realized that, heck, we're in the middle of a war and we're being attacked on every level of our being, body, mind, and soul. And so what the hell is going on, I think, is still the best overall picture of what's really going on, about the craziness in our world on all of these three levels. And the subtitle is The Web of Fraud That Is Enslaving Everyone and How We Can Escape to Freedom. And the book talks about roughly a dozen different frauds, and fraud is the right word for it. And I explain why that is in the book and explain what fraud is and how to recognize it. So it looks at the election fraud and the financial and currency fraud that's going on. It's not just mistakes. It's not the pattern of mistakes. That's an important theme in that book, is pattern recognition. And people are not recognizing the pattern of events and actions in the world because we've never been taught those patterns, right? So we look at events and we think we're looking at something that we're not. In 2020, a good part.
Before you move on, I do have a question that's coming up for me. So this pattern recognition you're talking about, how much of your own musical background helps in this way, in being able to recognize patterns?
But all of us recognize patterns.
Yes, right? Yes.
This is like the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's hardwired for pattern recognition. And I often use the example of just recognizing animals and birds. Like lots of people, I'm a little bit of a hunter and a fisherman. I love the outdoors, always been involved in the outdoors my whole life long, still am. Sometimes you'll be with a person who doesn't know anything about waterfowl, and they say, oh, look at those ducks. You say, actually, those are geese. Oh, how do you know? Because waterfowl, they all have a pattern, right? There's different sizes, there's different shapes, there's different colors, there's different silhouettes, either when you see them standing or in flight. They have different sounds, different calls that they make, all of these things, right? So as a hunter, you need to know this. You need to know whether this bird that's flying over, right? Is it an owl? Which are protected. You can't shoot them and you don't want to eat them anyway.
Right.
Or is it a goose? Or is it a swan? Can't shoot swans. Right. Or is it a duck? What kind of duck? Or is it a merganser or a grebe? You don't want to shoot them. You don't want to eat them. Or is it a loon? You need to know. And they all have different colors. They have different flight patterns, et cetera, et cetera, sizes, all this kind of stuff. So as a hunter, you learn to recognize the patterns of each different species of waterfowl. Now, does that mean that people who don't recognize them are stupid? No, they've just never been taught the patterns. And so it is in the world. When you see a certain pattern of event and people mistake it for something else, not because they're stupid, it's because they've never been taught that pattern. And when you learn the pattern, then you start seeing it all the time. You start recognizing it. It's like when you go and buy a new car, right?
Yep.
Several years ago, we bought a Hyundai Santa Fe, right? As soon as we bought the Hyundai Santa Fe, it started to say, hey, that's a Santa Fe, that's a Santa Fe. You see these all over the place. Before that, you hadn't even noticed.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So it's being familiar. So in that book, What the Hell's Going On, I teach people some of these key things. What's the pattern of communist subversion? Hardly anybody could tell you. But once you learn that pattern, then you see it happening all the time. What's the pattern of propaganda? What's the pattern of mind control? What's the pattern of fraud in general? What's the pattern of mistake versus lies? Right? How do you know when you see when somebody, it happens with politicians all the time and political parties? You think, oh, mistakes were made. No, no mistakes were made. They know exactly, at least the people who are behind it know exactly what they're doing.
Right.
Most
right.
people, of course, are always useful idiots. Now, this is not an insult. This is a technical term in communist communist theory and practice. A useful idiot is someone who goes along with the propaganda and goes along with the communist subversion or fascist subversion or whatever totalitarian name you want to call it, right? Because they believe what they were told. They think they're doing a good thing. They don't realize that they are a willing participant in spreading something that's terribly evil. And that's why the communist calls them useful idiots. They're useful in subverting a free society. And they're idiots because they don't recognize that they're what they're actually doing. So most people everywhere are useful idiots. They think they're doing something good. They think they know what's going on, and they don't because they've never been taught the pattern, so they don't recognize. But one thing I've noticed going back 20 or 30 years, and I got a good example of this too, is when politicians or governments bring in a certain law or pass a certain bill, and they say, this bill is going to accomplish such and such objectives. And when you look at it, and people knowledgeable with the subject say, this bill cannot possibly achieve those objectives. If you really want to achieve those objectives, there are ways you might be able to do that, but this is not it. And a good example is going back, 25 years, is in Canada, the federal government long gun registry, where everybody in Canada had to register their shotguns and rifles. And the federal government said, this is going to reduce crime. This is going to make the work of police forces easier because we'll have a complete database on all the guns in the country. And for example, if police get called out to a domestic dispute at some home, they can just look up on the database and they'll know whether there's guns in that home or not. Like, this is utter nonsense. And people, I remember at that time, I was actually a member of the Canadian Firearms Association, and we still got paper newsletters in those 8 days. You might be old enough to remember that, right? When you signed, we actually got newspapers on paper. We actually got magazines delivered to our home on paper. We actually, if you signed up for any kind of a newsletter, right? If you were part of a group like the Canadian Firearms Association, you typically have a monthly or a quarterly newsletter that they'd send you in the mail on paper. I remember reading an article by whoever at that time was the president or whatever the title is of the Canadian Firearm, talking about going to meet with the whatever it was, Minister of Public Safety or whatever the relevant thing, and explaining to them step by step how, like, this has been tried before. For example, in New Zealand, they did exactly the same thing before us. In fact, it almost looked like Canada took the New Zealand bill and just copied it. Probably did, right? And it didn't work. They ended up having to, after spending a huge amount of money, they ended up scrapping it because it didn't work, didn't achieve any of their objectives. First of all, who registers their guns? The law-abiding, honest people.
Right.
They're not the people who commit crimes. The criminals, who are the people who actually commit crimes with firearms, they don't register their guns. They're using illegal and unregistered firearms anyway, usually handguns.
Yes.
of which in Canada, for decades and decades, there has always been extremely tight regulations on handguns, right? It's basically impractical unless the only people who own handguns are people who are actually involved in handgun shooting competitions. And this is a sport that they're involved with, right? They jump through all the massive hoops and stuff. Nobody else can be bothered with it except criminals. And they buy illegal handguns that are brought illegally across the border from the United States, not sold in Canada, never registered anywhere. It's so stupid. And no police officer in his right mind would ever believe the database. If you're going to go in to a home where there's a kind of a violent domestic dispute going on, the only logical thing to do is to assume there are weapons in that house, regardless of what the database tells you. You got to protect yourself. This has absolutely no value. The criminals
Point of the bill then?
Okay. So the whole point is, I know it's a long story, but this is an example, like a glaring example of the government knew ahead of time that the bill that they were passing could not possibly achieve its stated objectives. So why did they do it? It's not a mistake. This is a pattern. When governments bring in legislation that cannot possibly achieve its stated objectives, it's not a mistake. It's a fraud. They're not stupid. They're liars. They're lying about what the real purpose of the legislation is. And when it comes to gun control, the real purpose of the legislation is not to so much to control guns, but to control people and to gradually disarm the population. And this, we've seen this throughout history. Hitler did the same thing in Germany, right? You don't want an armed population if you want to subjugate and abuse the population. You don't want them to be able to fight back. Now, if you have no intention of mistreating your population, why would you care?
Now, could you make the argument, and I agree with your point, but could you make the argument then the alternative is what you're having in the US, right? Where there's all these shootings. But what I was also hearing from you is those guns are often illegally taken,
right? In Canada. Like
Canada. So that's the question, right? So would the alternative be, if you didn't have this program, for example, or this bill, then would the alternative be what we're seeing in the US with all these gun shootings?
Not necessarily. Everybody points to the United States. Yeah. And that's not simply, it's much more complicated and nuanced than that, as life always is.
Right.
It's, and I've thought about this, I've read about it for many decades, because this gun control issue has been going on for many decades. It's not new. And it's more, I think, a culture issue in the United States rather than simply the existence of firearms in private hands. I think there are more murders per capita in the United States than in Canada or in other countries. But the difference is that with firearms so readily available in the United States, a very large proportion of the murders in the United States are done with firearms. Whereas in Canada, firearms are not, at least the last time I looked at the statistics, which was a long time ago, knives were the most common weapon of murder in Canada. So anything can become a weapon. Right? A rock can be a weapon. A stick can be a weapon. And people are sometimes murdered with rocks and sticks and hammers and pipe wrenches. If you want to kill somebody, and particularly in an instance of those murders that we call crimes of passion, where like you become angry and furious with someone, and just in a fit of rage, you pick up something near at hand and it's a knife or it's a hammer or it's something else that you... Whereas in the United States, it's a gun in many households is near at hand.
And it's scale, right? With a gun, you can have mass shootings. Whereas with a rock or, I know this is nuanced, but with a rock or a hammer, you're not necessarily killing multiple people at once, right? Whereas with a gun.
It's not so common, but mm-hmm. There are definitely examples of that as well. And I can't remember everything off the
right.
top of my head.
Yeah, yeah.
A man with a knife in a crowded public space,
mm-hmm.
if nobody else has a weapon, can kill and injure an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a simple fact of being human. We
yes.
are almost defenseless creatures. When you look mm-hmm. at human evolution, right? People have pondered about this for a very long time. How can we're supposed to have evolved into better adapted characteristics?
Yes.
How can this possibly be better adapted? We have no hair on our bodies. We don't have fangs or claws. Like, we're virtually defenseless. We're mm-hmm. extremely vulnerable. How could we have possibly evolved this way, right?
Mm.
And we don't have a hard shell to protect us. We can't run faster than most of our likely predators.
Yes.
Like, how can this be? But anyway, so a man with a weapon has so much greater advantage over a man without a weapon.
Yeah.
That almost any weapon will do to kill multiple people.
Mm. Yeah.
And so we do have instances, and I remember reading about him in the newspaper from time to time, that mm-hmm. somebody with a knife stabbing dozens of people before he stopped, mm-hmm. most of whom are wounded, but some die.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, you take a fully automatic weapon into a crowded place, you can kill a lot of people. However, you also have to understand that almost nobody does, that the majority of these mass casualty events,
mm-hmm.
are not what they say they are.
Yeah.
They're not random, one crazy guy going, they're not what they say they are.
Yeah.
I'll just leave it at that. There's often many other things, but.
Yeah. Okay. And coming back to the useful idiot piece, I find that pretty interesting because I guess, how do you discern, right? Because you said it's someone who thinks they're doing some good, but they're probably propagating the propaganda. So how do we know, like people like yourself or even me, how do we know we're not playing into this useful idiot role?
Oh, you used a good word, Furkan, discernment. Mm. And it's very difficult because basically all of us are being subjected to mind control.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's this book, the follow-up book to What the Hell's Going On, The Way Forward.
Yes.
Which focuses on the three types of warfare that we're being subjected to and how we can sensibly respond. So on each of the three levels of our existence as humans, body, mind, and soul. So on the physical level, it's what's called fifth generation warfare. Plus we have psychological warfare, or we could call it mind control. Or the newest term for mind control is engineered reality. I'll come back to that. So we have physical warfare, we have psychological warfare, and we have spiritual warfare. And all three are being conducted against us. And so what The Way Forward does tries to explain the basics of each of those three types of warfare, how they're being conducted against us, and how we can sensibly respond. Because many people have tried and are trying to respond, but our response has not always, it's very often been ineffective.
Mm.
And so that's the point of The Way Forward. How can we sensibly and effectively respond? But you asked me about mind control, or how can we not be useful idiots? We have to assume mind control is actually very simple. And that's one of the things that if I ever get around to writing an updated version of The Way Forward, I don't think I made that clear enough in The Way Forward. Was all of us think, oh, mind control is really difficult and nobody's controlling my mind. But the thing is that it's really simple and it's all of us are affected by it. So you have to start out with the knowledge that, okay, my mind is being manipulated and controlled and go from there, right? So every bit of information that enters your awareness, you have to kind of take a step back and try to consciously evaluate it. And this is impossible because there's too much information that enters our awareness.
Yes.
So that's a part of where understanding some of the patterns that are typically used to manipulate us, the patterns of thought. I don't know, where do you want me to go? So many different directions.
I guess just to maybe take a step back and set the stage for the book itself, because a lot of the times there's criticism around even talking about these things, because it's a critique that's often used is, oh, this is just inducing more fear. But I don't think this is your intention. What I understand with you wanting to do this work is to bring awareness and not induce fear that, oh, all this stuff is happening. No, all this stuff is happening, yet still we can do something about it. So I just wanted to perhaps put that out there first. Now, when it comes to mind control, there's different words I've heard. Sometimes people will use the matrix. Sometimes people will use PSYOP. Is this the same concept that you're alluding to, but just often people are using different terms to describe it?
There are different terms used to describe essentially the same thing. But the term the matrix has a much broader meaning. Going back in time, several decades, we used to talk about psychological warfare.
Yeah.
Right. And then the next term that came into use, starting with, and I do mention it in, and reference it in the book, What the Hell's Going On, an important paper coming from two United States Army military intelligence officers, one of whom, for the second one, I don't know his history, but the first one, like a well-known Satanist, which not surprising, these things go together, but they brought the term mind war, right? So this is warfare at the level of the mind, which is psychological warfare, but they expanded this concept, not simply psychological warfare. I'll just let that aside. But what they said was different about mind war is that you want to manipulate the very context, the worldview, you might say, the very context in which people evaluate information. And so they brought in the word mind war, and mind control also used to mean the same thing. And the fact that this mind war is fundamentally, as I mentioned, conditioning or establishing the mental framework or the mental context in which people evaluate all information. That's why the term engineered reality has come about. Because what this psychological warfare, psychological operations, so psychological operations is simply an operation that you do within the context of warfare. Right, psychological warfare. So the psychological operation is a narrower term. But engineered reality, so what they do is that they want to create, because all of us have what we call a worldview, right?
Yes.
Which is our understanding of reality. And as part of, an important part of that is who we are and our place within that reality. But it's always a perception. That's what we forget. Almost all of us think that, I understand reality. I know what's real and what's not real. And we all naturally assume that our understanding of reality is pretty close to perfect.
Yes.
If there was anything really important going on in the world, I would know about it. So we have this natural arrogance. Of course, partly it comes from the fact that we don't know what we don't know. So we have no idea of that body of knowledge that we're not aware of. And so it's easy to assume that it either doesn't exist or it must be pretty small and not important. So, but every one of us has a different perception of reality, a different understanding or misunderstanding of reality and what's real and what's not real. And so what engineered reality tries to do is to create in everyone's mind a perception of reality that suits the purposes of the attacker. So we are in a war, a very long-running massive war that's being conducted against us on all three levels, body, mind, and soul, whoever is behind it, and I don't know exactly, and I don't think anybody knows exactly who's at the top of this mysterious hierarchy that we can't see. But we can know some things about it, but we definitely don't know anywhere nearly everything about it.
Right.
But someone is attacking us. Someone, something, whatever it is, attacking us. That's obvious once you look at it and learn to recognize the patterns of these different types of warfare. And the fundamental way they are doing it is through engineered reality, through having us in our minds without us even being aware of it. They're constructing our sense of reality for us. And so when something, information comes in that doesn't fit with our worldview, our understanding of reality, we dismiss it out of hand. So when you, oh, these are crazy conspiracy theorist guys who say that, whatever, all kinds of things, that say that there's aliens, or say that there's a secret space program, or say that the government is trying to kill us with COVID, or that the governments are trying to engineer famine with the collapse of the food system. Like this, you guys are crazy. So that's all, that stuff is just dismissed out of mind. And our minds do work this way. It is very interesting in What the Hell's Going On. I do quote this too. A famous book published mid 20th century called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Thomas Kuhn, I think. You might have you heard of this book?
I haven't heard of the book, but I'm familiar with Thomas Kuhn's work. So
he kind of explained, very importantly, he said that when we have a revolution in scientific thinking, the way it always worked, whether it's with Galileo or Copernicus, right, or Einstein, or all of these things, right, whatever, we have a revolution in science, you have an existing scientific theory about something. Whether it's the universe or whatever it is.
The book is called, I just looked it up, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions and Paradigm Shifts.
So everybody thinks, okay, this existing accepted theory, that's the way things are. And then what happens is little bits of information come in that don't fit with that theory. They conflict with it. So how do we respond? And it's not a personality flaw. This is how our minds work. We reject that information. Not true. You can't believe that. That's the kind of scientific terms you hear. That's an outlier. That's an outlier. We're going to just disregard that, or you shoot the messenger. Oh, that guy got his PhD from the University of Alberta. You can't, he doesn't really know what he's doing. Or that guy, he's whatever. He comes from Romania. He doesn't really know anything. He's not educated to the level of that we are in the West, right? Or that guy's this, or that guy's that. Like you, this is a well-known logical fallacy, right? Called, what's the name of that logical fallacy? Slipped my mind. Anyways, shoot the message. The messenger is unreliable. So his data, his information, whatever his experiment showed, it's not real. He made mistakes. There were problems with his method, all kinds of things. Just our mind just rejects it out of hand. And we latch on to any excuse, even logical fallacies that scientists should know about, right? And consciously try to avoid the logical fallacies if they're real scientists. But it's very difficult to be a real scientist because you have to force your mind to work in a way that our minds don't work. So that's what happened. Information starts coming in. And everybody rejects it for a whole bunch of host of reasons, right? And so it's rejected, then it's ignored. We're not going to include that stuff in the textbooks. It's rejected, it's ignored. The people who brought it forward are ridiculed. Sometimes they're fired from their jobs. We see a heck of a lot of that going on in the last decade, right? Fired. Even people, tenured university professors that are fired for the strangest thing. How can you fire somebody with tenure? Whatever, for a comment on social media or some absolutely stupid thing, right? But happening all over the place today. But it's always happened. So then only when there's an avalanche of data and information that simply cannot be, you can stand out there in the snow and deny that there's snow falling, deny that there's snow around you. You can do all this denial up until the point where the avalanche comes through and swats you away. And then reality kind of swats you upside the head and you can't ignore it anymore. Mm-hmm. And then it forces a reevaluation of the paradigm that everybody had, the scientific paradigm in the case that Thomas Kuhn was talking about. Mm-hmm. But it happens with everything in our lives, our worldview. When information comes into our world that doesn't fit with our worldview, that's how our minds work. We reject it. We say it's not true, or that person's weird, or you spend some time in a mental institute, or whatever. We dismiss it for a whole host of reasons until the evidence becomes so overwhelming that we simply can't ignore it anymore. And then there's a revolutionary restructuring of our worldview or of our paradigm of reality.
Right. Yeah.
And we switch to a new one. Not that the new one is right, but at least it incorporates the new information. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on. And so if you can condition a person's worldview in such a way that it suits your interests as an attacker, you can get them to reject information for a very long time. Mm. For example, that's what happened with COVID.
Yeah, I was going to use that as an example.
Had that. You just couldn't talk to people. They wouldn't accept it. Oh, don't talk to me about that. Have you noticed people who got the shot are dying? Oh, you're making that shit up. You're a conspiracy theorist. The evidence is right there. I did two long speaking tours after What the Hell's Going On was published. I did a book and speaking tour all across Canada. And then the next year I published The Way Forward, did another long book and speaking tour. The most dramatic example I have of this is when I was spoke in Grand Prairie one time, a lady came up to me afterwards and she said, there were three of us couples, lived in the same neighborhood. Our kids were all the same age, played with each other. We did all kinds of stuff together. We went camping together. We were the best of friends. And she said, when the vax came along, I was the only one of the six, three couples, husband and wife. I was the only one of the six that refused, that wouldn't take the vax. And she said, now of the six, I'm the only one left alive. And she, at that time, she was in her early 60s, not old, but I'm in my late 60s. So early 60s to me is not old at all. So she was a healthy woman in her early 60s. She said, I buried my husband a year ago and I buried my best friend 3 months ago. So six people, five took the shot, one didn't. Within a few years, the five were dead. That's the most dramatic example I've come across. But every family has stories like this of people dying after taking the shot. But many people within those families will simply refuse to attribute their illness, their disability, of the death to the fact that they took the COVID shot. So, because it doesn't fit in their worldview. It's
well, and I think that one's a good example, because now what I've observed is that paradigm shift has happened, that it's just one of those things, which is strange, is just accepted that it was just, there's something not right about COVID, right? And everyone talks about it now openly because it's just, to your point, it's just now you can't just ignore it because there's so much data and information supporting that. Now, the other, I guess it would be important to talk about the other forms of warfare that you mentioned. So the physical one, can you expand on that, including the spiritual warfare? So.
Sure. So what we call, and hey, like I've been a band director, like what would I know about warfare? But when I realized that I was being subjected to it, you have to start learning about stuff that you never paid attention to because it's relevant to our lives now.
Correct.
Anyway, so fifth generation warfare, this takes a little explaining. So the Chinese have a different term that's essentially the same. They call it unrestricted warfare. And this term, unrestricted warfare, comes from a now famous paper published by a couple of Chinese military officers, People's Liberation Army officers, going back about 25 years ago when they talked about unrestricted warfare. Whereas the Chinese military strategists realized that they can't win a typical war against the United States. Mm-hmm. There's no way. So if we're going to defeat the United States, we have to figure out different ways of doing it. We have to figure out different ways of warfare. So they look at all these things like biological warfare, chemical warfare, psychological warfare, lawfare, all of these different kinds of warfare, and including when, for those of our listeners who have understood it, the whole COVID campaign was a campaign of biological warfare and even more importantly, psychological warfare.
Mm.
So that was a part of unrestricted warfare from the perspective of the Chinese. Now, starting in about the 1980s, the American military strategists came up with a little bit different way of looking at changes in warfare over the years. But they end up in the same place with fifth generation warfare. So what the American military strategists did is they have divided the changes in modern warfare. So we're talking about modern warfare going back 300 years or so to really to what was that famous treaty in about 1650 that's established the rules and the structure of modern warfare. The Treaty of such and such, the place in Europe slips my mind at the moment. Anyway,
is so it basically the Treaty of Treaty of Hartford?
No. It might come to me, but it's not sure. Anyway, so first generation warfare, characterized by everything up to the American Civil War, and including the beginning of the American Civil War. Really, actually, yeah, including pretty much the whole of the American Civil War, where you have single projectile weapon, like muskets, and a rather limited artillery, right? So your artillery is projecting still a single projectile, and its range is limited, its devastation, et cetera. And because weapons and tactics always go together. That's why we have the term SWAT, right? Special weapons and tactics. Because when you change the weapons, you invariably have to change the tactics, excuse me, both to take advantage of those weapons and on the other side to defend against those weapons. So when you change weapons, you change tactics. So the different generations represent changes in weapons and tactics. So first generation warfare, you have single projectile weapons and you have military tactics that are what we call line and column, right? Your infantry is assembled in lines and there's columns and you have your infantry, cavalry, artillery, and you have battles that are limited in geographic scope so that you typically have the commander, the commanding general sitting up on a hill or up on a horse, if that's all that's possible, where he is overseeing the whole battle and is issuing commands. Send in the cavalry over there. Send the reserves up to bolster those guys over there. Bring the artillery up and do that. And you have a command structure where information travel, a very rigid command structure where information travels up and down. Okay, so the commanding general will issue a command maybe to a colonel, send a command down to a major, a captain, a lieutenant, et cetera, whatever. A very rigid command structure. Now, that's the American Civil, up to the American Civil War. Now, second generation, characterized by World War I, where unfortunately, as always, because generals are always fighting the last war, because they haven't yet figured out how to change the tactics to accommodate the new weapons. So the tactics of most of World War I were fought with line and column. Oh, just send more men through the no man's land and into the across the barbed wire and send them into the artillery barrage and the machine guns. And that's why you had battles like the Somme where you lost 100,000 men in one day. It is absolutely murderous because they hadn't figured out how to use tactics. So World War One. Now we have multiple firing weapons like machine guns, totally changed the battlefield. It made cavalry absolutely useless. You just mow down the cavalry and with your machine guns. And you have absolutely massive artillery that you're firing shells now so far away, you can't see where they're landing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes the battlefield so large that it's impossible for one general to see the whole battlefield. He can't know what's going on everywhere. Through this rigid structure becomes exceedingly difficult. So second generation warfare, you have multiple firing weapons and you have incredibly massive artillery. Okay, now we move to third generation warfare characterized by World War II, which the Germans had figured out and mastered before World War II even began, which led to their early victories before their enemies started to figure out how to respond. So also called maneuver warfare, third generation warfare, also called maneuver warfare, because rapid movement is now possible and in fact necessary. Everything becomes motorized. Infantry is motorized. In the panzer divisions, you don't have infantry marching anymore. You put them on trucks or in rail cars and you ship them instead of marching 10 or 20 or 30 miles a day. You can ship them 200, 300 miles a day.
Right?
You have mobile infantry. You have essentially mobile artillery in tanks and in aircraft. You have ground attack aircraft, right?
Yep.
And it makes everything happen on the battlefield very quickly. Battlefields got even larger.
Yes.
Right? And it was in World War I, and in World War II, commanders started to figure this out. They somewhat accommodated using radios and stuff, the difficulty of communication. But even more importantly is that command got shifted down lower in the military hierarchy. Okay, so the commanders on the ground were given far more latitude to make operational and tactical decisions on the battlefield because they couldn't do it any other way. So you had, instead of the general in charge issuing commands, now he was issuing objectives. Okay, here's our objective. This group of guys, colonels, you're in charge of this group of men. Your objectives are this. Colonels, you're over here. You're in command of this. Your objectives are this, right? The various colonels would know how all the objectives fit together. But then the colonel would say to his majors and captains, okay, you're going to do this. You can do that. And then the captains and even lieutenants, and sometimes the lieutenants killed, even sergeants and corporals on the ground, were allowed and encouraged to make tactical decisions in the heat of the battle based on what's going on, right? So the command and control structure becomes quite different, much more flexible. The battles are fluid. If you run into a really tough spot, a hardened defensive position, just go around it. Don't waste 2 weeks in a fixed battle here. No, go around it. Encircle it. We'll bring our ground attack aircraft in to pummel it. We'll cut off its supplies. The battlefield becomes very fluid. Battles happen very quickly. And this is how the German army destroyed the roughly equal, actually on paper, even slightly superior French army in 6 weeks in the spring of 1940. Because the French army was using second generation warfare tactics and the German army was using third generation warfare tactic. And so that's World War II, third generation warfare. Now, and we still see some of that going on at the beginning of the war in Ukraine, for example. We saw some of that going on, but now it's changed. Warfare today, they got to come up with a sixth generation warfare because we're seeing drone warfare. I heard recently that 90% of casualties, both in terms of personnel and military equipment, 90% of all casualties in the Ukraine war are being done by drones. So it's drone warfare. Now, this is something completely different again. And you can't use World War II tactics. Like the tanks get destroyed. Your personnel carriers get destroyed. Your artillery gets destroyed very quickly. It's very different. It's a completely different type of warfare and people are still adjusting to it. Okay, so now, so we have first, second, third generation warfare. Fourth generation warfare, the American military stratus, count as essentially what we would call guerrilla warfare of all types. So the Vietnam War, for example, was essentially guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of tactics. The decentralization of command is taken even further. So you have local little groups doing stuff largely on their own. And it becomes exceedingly difficult to fight against that. Mm-hmm. You can't successfully use third generation warfare tactics when you're fighting an insurgency war, fourth generation warfare.
Yes.
So a couple of key things. As I mentioned, the command and control is exceedingly decentralized, almost to the point where it doesn't matter. Like you could take out the leader and it wouldn't matter, right? If you go back to the Battle of Waterloo, if anybody had killed Wellington, the English would have lost. And remember, there's a fact, I just watched this movie again a little while ago. It was made a long time ago, decades ago, about the Battle of Waterloo. And if anybody, this is a little story, but it's funny. Because it had been raining for days and the field was so muddy, they couldn't move their artillery pieces around. The cavalry, the horses were slipping in the mud. So both the English and the French just stood there looking at each other for hours all morning long until the field of battle dried up enough that they could move their artillery. Then they start about 11 or 12 o'clock, they started firing. The battle began, but they're all out there since sunrise, just standing there. And in the meantime, there's this scene in the movie. I don't know if it happened for sure or not. But Wellington's kind of laying down under a tree with his hat kind of half over his face, having a rest or a snooze or something. And one of his generals comes up to him, Wellington, sir.
Yeah.
We were just thinking that, wouldn't it be helpful we knew what your plan is?
It's sweaty.
And he replies, my plan is to defeat the French. I don't know if that's accurate, but it's like it's a little vignette of what it could be like in a first generation warfare battle. Mm-hmm. Only the commanding general really needs to know the whole battle plan.
Yeah.
Okay? But when, as we get down through the lower levels of the subsequent generations of warfare, everybody becomes more and more decentralized, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in fourth generation warfare or insurgency warfare, it's all this. And we have, for the first time since the Westphalia, the Treaty of Westphalia, and I think it was 1648, but I could be wrong, somewhere around. Mm-hmm. Treaty of Westphalia. That's where all the European countries agreed that soldiers all had to wear identifying uniforms, that only soldiers would take part in warfare, et cetera, et cetera. But now in insurgency warfare, you have, for the first time since the Treaty of Westphalia, non-state actors taking a role in warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Viet Cong was not a nation state.
Right.
And most of the Vietnam War was fought against the Viet Cong, not the North Vietnamese Army.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a non-state actor who is really fighting against you in ways that your third gen, like your tanks and all this kind of stuff, your aircraft, the amount of bombs that the Americans dropped in Vietnam, absolutely unbelievable, but it didn't work. Mm-hmm. Like, you couldn't defeat an insurgency warfare that way. So fourth generation warfare is insurgency of all types. Now, fifth generation warfare takes all of the trends that we've been seeing to their extreme. Not only are non-state actors taking an active role in warfare, but you typically don't even know who your enemy really is.
Mm.
In fact, one of the first principles of fifth generation warfare is you don't want your enemy to know he's under attack until he's defeated.
Mm.
You want to do everything except what we call kinetic warfare. So nobody's dropping bombs on you. Nobody's shooting you with guns. You don't see tanks. You don't see it.
Right.
It's everything else. It's psychological warfare. It's mind control. It's biological warfare. It's chemical warfare. It's lawfare. It's taking control of social structures within society. It's manipulating elections. This becomes election warfare. If you get elected to the, for example, China has, I don't know how many of our listeners might know, but China has for decades now had this absolutely massive, essentially, if we want to call it psychological warfare campaign and unrestricted warfare campaign against all the West by undermining, infiltrating all of our political and social organizations. And they've had this program called the Unified. Interestingly, exactly the same term that the Russian communists used in the 1920s and 30s. It was the, that's not unified. If you follow, there's a Canadian investigative journalist who recently published the book called, this is a problem with getting old. You forget stuff. His Substack is called The Bureau. I'm just pulling it up so you can remember. Sam Cooper.
Yeah.
Sam Cooper published the book. Can't remember. But his specialty is investigating Chinese influence.
Okay.
So
Willful Blindness?
Blindness. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And now I don't know what I've done here, but there we go. Willful Blindness. He explains how the Chinese Communist Party, originally abbreviated the CPP, Chinese Communist Party, how the CPP has this massive network of getting political influence in countries all over the world. And it's just thoroughly infiltrated Canadian politics at all levels, at the federal level, at the provincial levels, even at municipal levels, particularly in cities like Vancouver and Toronto, where there's big Chinese population.
Mm. Mm.
So this is part of fifth generation warfare, right? You undermine, if your enemy never responds to warfare, then you're going to take them over. This is what's been going on in Canada. They've been subverting, taking control of politicians, bribing, intimidating. That's what the Chinese police stations on Canadian soil, right? I don't know if our readers have heard of that. You've probably heard of that. And it's not just Canada. It's every country in the world.
It's
in the United States. It's in European countries. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And most of the work of those Chinese police stations on foreign soil is to manipulate, threaten, and use as assets, we say in the intelligence business, the local Chinese population. And they do that by threatening their families back in China, right? If you don't go along with this, things are going to be tough for your parents who are still living in China or whoever's left in China. Mm-hmm. So this is a type of warfare, right? Mm-hmm. It's subversive political warfare. Mm-hmm. In fact, all totalitarian regimes have come to power and maintained their power using these methods. The Nazis, the Bolsheviks, the fascists, and everywhere. This is always done. And the Chinese Communist Party is doing it all over the world. So that's fifth generation warfare. Everything that's non-kinetic. Sorry, it took a long time. I said it.
No, that's
explained quickly.
No, I appreciate that. So what about the spiritual warfare then?
Okay. So spiritual warfare, and we're going on a long time, so I'll try to make this a little bit quicker.
Yeah.
And you're familiar with Dr. David Hawkins.
Yes.
So in my book, The Way Forward, when I talk about spiritual warfare, I explain about what he calls a map of consciousness.
Yes.
That our consciousness, or you might say our spiritual awareness or spiritual development, we can maybe roughly use those kind of words as being interchangeable. Mm. Our consciousness ranges from he created a scale for this. The map of consciousness is a scale. And it's a logarithmic scale. And it runs from 0 to 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an important pivot point at 200. Below the level of 200, one sees oneself as being a victim, as not having power over events around us. That people and events around us have power over us that we can't change. But at 200 is the level of courage. And so that becomes important. You develop the courage to actually take positive action to improve your own life. Lower levels, you don't take action to improve your own life. You just complain or blame. And so below the level of 200, you are completely controllable.
Mm-hmm.
Above the level of 200, you gradually become more and more difficult to control because you take responsibility for your own life. You act in ways that are for your benefit and the benefit of those around you, benefit of your communities. You develop courage. You stand up to those forces that might be trying to control, manipulate you, push you around. And so the whole goal of spiritual warfare is to keep people in a low level of consciousness, below the level of 200, because they are controllable. And we can also see the spiritual spectrum as having, as being a continuum of fear versus love. Fear is on the left, the dark side, or whatever, and love is that. And we have throughout religious writings, we have this idea presented over and over again, although not quite so clearly as being on a simple spectrum, right? St. John said, perfect love casts out all fear, as it does. Like the way, and I told my music students as a band director and a music teacher for many years, because I learned this when I was a kid, something that's hard to do, simple but not easy, as I always say, that how do you overcome nervousness when you get up to play in front of people and everybody's nervous, right?
Yes.
How do you overcome that? You overcome it with love, right? Rather than getting up there and seeing all these people as judging you, right? See them all as loving you. They love you and they are hoping and praying for your success. They want to be entertained or inspired with a beautiful musical performance. And if you think of loving them, it will wash away your fear. And I taught my music students this for years. And this is true in all aspects of our life. Love is the only thing that really overcomes fear.
Yes.
And so as you move towards love, so on the map of consciousness, the scale, love is at the level of 500. Right? Fear is at the level of 100. And it's a logarithmic scale, right? So 500 is not five times higher than 100. It's, what is that, 10 to the fifth?
Yeah.
Anyway, not sure. Yeah. It's 10 to the fifth or 100,000 times more powerful.
Right.
So by raising our consciousness out of the lower levels of fear, shame, anger, resentment, blame, all that kind of stuff, into the levels of courage, acceptance, love, the love, all the levels in the 400 are the intellectual levels of consciousness, right? And then 500 is the level of love. And then I think 540 is the level of peace, et cetera. Something like that, right? So as we, so in my writings, I say, like, shoot for love.
Right.
One person who can maintain the consciousness of love will counterbalance millions in the consciousness of fear.
And
not only do you protect yourself from these spiritual attacks by raising your own consciousness, but you help to raise the whole collective consciousness dramatically by raising your own consciousness.
Well, and so that's what I appreciated about David Hawkins' work was he encourages that, right? It's easy to fall victim to, oh, all these forces are at play. What am I going to do? There's really no point. But to your, what you've highlighted here and what David Hawkins talks about too, is you can, by taking on the agency and doing the work in your own corner of the world, you are still making a big impact on the collective consciousness. I think that's worth emphasizing. The other question I have, and this is an easy target, especially nowadays, but it is worth talking about because of the psychological, spiritual, even fifth generation warfare that you touched on, the role social media is playing in all of this and in shaping people's worldviews and how they see things. And then that whole echo chamber you can fall into yourself, depending on what you're interacting with. So this is just another example of what one can consider a form of a tool that's being used.
Oh, absolutely. Social media is such a powerful tool of mind control, right? Because it's, again, engineered reality.
Yes.
It is forming your whole worldview, your whole perception of what's real and what's not real, of what's true and what's not true. all that kind of stuff. And we also need to understand that, especially today, wasn't when it first started and it was a small thing 25 years ago or so, but it certainly is today. Social media is exceedingly manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge amount of it is actually bots, right? It's electronic robots. It's manipulated. People's posts are either promoted or obscured. So many people in the last really decade or more have said, oh, I'm being shadow banned. Nobody's seeing my posts. Mm. Yeah, that's right. Because somebody, whoever's behind this, doesn't want you to see those posts. And you know what? Like companies like Facebook and whatnot, they've now admitted this,
mm-hmm.
right? Particularly during COVID. Like this isn't speculation or conspiracy theory anymore. They've all admitted to it, that the government, the United States government, and happened in every country. It's not just the United States, but this has come out in the United States very publicly, that the government, and not just part of, like, there were something like 20 or 30 different government departments that were directly connected with Facebook and Twitter and all these other ones, who were telling them who to deplatform, who to cancel, whose posts to hide and bury and all this kind of stuff, who's to bring out. And then the government itself became in some places and for a while, the biggest advertiser on all media during COVID.
Yeah.
Right. I remember even a little local example. When COVID happened, I'd retired from teaching, but was still living in Peace River. There's this little tiny radio station near Peace River, right? Just has a little local audience. The guy operates it out of his basement, right? And like everybody around there knows him.
Mm.
And people went and talked to him and said, hey, like, please tell on your radio station, everybody's burying this, tell what's really happening. Mm. And even he said, oh, I can't, right? I'm getting so much money from the government advertising right now, I can't do anything to jeopardize that.
Mm.
Operating a little radio station out of his basement in Peace River, even he was getting so much government money that he wouldn't jeopardize that to tell the truth. And that was happening with all media outlets, type social media, mainstream media, everywhere. So you have to understand with social media, all that it's manipulated. Mm. And it's like I've said in my books, you have to follow the advice that, what was his name, gave to Indiana Jones. Trust no one.
Mm. Yeah.
Of course, and that's impossible to do, but you have to look into as much as you can. And
absolutely.
At the same time, be open-minded and aware that because of the way our mind works, we naturally reject information that doesn't fit with our worldview, but balance that with the understanding that we've been lied to on a massive scale. So most of our worldview is wrong. So be open-minded to okay, I'm wrong about a whole bunch of stuff, but I don't know which stuff is wrong and I don't know which stuff is right. That's kind of how I approach things nowadays. Mm-hmm, I try to look for the patterns that I understand. And I have, over the last 6 or 7 years since COVID, figured out some of the sources of information that I trust and who definitely not to trust, like the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we get off. Now, you had mentioned, if I could touch on this, you had mentioned earlier in our interview that in my books, I don't wallow in fear. The term blackpilled has come up about this, right?
Yes.
All these terrible things are going on in the world. Oh, everything's going wrong. This is bad and this is bad. And then there's no hope, right? That's being blackpilled, to descend into hopelessness. No, we need to, if you want to solve a problem, you must first understand what the problem is.
Yes.
So my two books, What the Hell's Going On and The Way Forward, they're in an attempt to explain to people as well as I understand it, at least, what these problems are and what we can sensibly do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to develop the courage to do something and move ahead and take positive steps on all the levels of body, mind, and soul.
Yes.
And I lay them all out in not everything, but I lay out enough the principles, the ideas, and then it's up to each person to develop their, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do to right. avoid fear and hopelessness and steer myself more and more consistently towards love, acceptance, forgiveness, forgiving those people that I think are trying to commit genocide and murder the world. Almost nobody has talked about this. But yeah, we have to come to the point of forgiving Anthony Fauci and Teresa Tam and all these people who are legitimately guilty of genocide and fraud and all sorts of things. But I also make this point very clearly too. This is a state of spiritual consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not hard to understand. Mm-hmm. We have to be willing to accept the simple idea that we cannot solve problems by killing people.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say it again, because it's so important. We cannot solve problems by killing people.
Mm-hmm.
So the problems that we have now are not going to be solved by killing Anthony Fauci or Teresa Tam or whoever else you think is a mass murderer and may well be. That we have to, and we can. There are solutions to all of our problems that do not involve killing people, and we have to find those solutions that do not involve killing people.
Yeah.
So that's the direction we need to move in.
Yes. Yes. And it's hard to sometimes to see that, especially in the world today where there is war still happening, probably a bigger one. You alluded to the Ukraine-Russia one, but then there's the recent one in Iran too, right? So I think we need to recognize that. But I think key takeaways, if I were to summarize what I've heard from you, is first is to educate yourself. Yes. Recognize the problem, recognize the patterns that are at play. You've obviously laid some out, but there's others that we need to understand. And then the second piece is do your own work, the spiritual work that we talked about, maybe trying to go into that state of love, but even beyond that, in peace and joy, if you can create that for yourself and you can shift that for other people as well through the collective consciousness. And then I guess the last piece is the forgiveness piece that you and I talked about over the weekend. And my view, I shared with you as well, I think there is that hierarchy of forgiveness that we create by telling ourselves that we need to forgive. It's something I'm going to explore on my Substack too. But I think just the biggest piece is what you and I touched on in that conversation was it's easier to forgive if we even want to consider that. If we recognize that things are happening for us, right? And as hard as it is in the moment to realize that even if someone wrongs us in our personal life, maybe it is a gift and that is part of our growth. And that person, as hard as it may be to view it that way, is a teacher or maybe even a guide. So just recognizing that there is still growth in that experience. And we are, as much as everything you've highlighted can seem daunting at times, there's still growth happening individually and collectively. The fact that we're having these conversations to me demonstrates that there's growth.
Absolutely. Right on. Well done.
Thank you. Donald, thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate your time. Would love to keep talking more, whether it's online like this or offline. Considering now you're back in Alberta too, so you're not too far. But yeah, looking forward to more of these. Any final parting thoughts, or how can the audience, if they wanted to learn more about your work, how can they find that as well?
Yeah, the best thing is to go to my author website. It's easy to remember, www.comingHomeSpirit.com, because we're all on a spiritual journey back home to God from whence we came. So it's comingHomeSpirit.com. And if you would, I send you that little email ahead of time. If you would also put the link to my, I have a free gift, actually two, and I'll mention, but the link I sent you was directly to get to download a free little ebook that contains five of the 50 parables in my first book, The Man Director's Lessons About Life, plus the introductions and stuff like that. But so if you go to that, if you go to that page, that will take you to my Shopify store. And all you need to, you'll also find there if you're interested, I also have another free little ebook, which is on spiritual warfare.
Mm.
And so we talked a little bit about spiritual warfare. We didn't get into too much. So I've taken parts of my chapter on spiritual warfare from The Way Forward and put them into a little free ebook. So if anyone wants to kind of get a quick, I call it a primer on spiritual warfare. So if anyone wants to learn a little bit more about spiritual warfare, get my primer. That one can be downloaded for free also from my Shopify. And that's just cominghomespirit.myshopify.com.
Okay. No, we'll include all of that in the show note captions, and the listeners can easily follow along to see where they can find all this stuff, including some of those gifts. So thank you for sharing all of that. But again, appreciate your time today and everything you shared with us. So like I said, looking forward to more of these conversations.
Let's do it.
All right.
Thank you. It's been a joy and a pleasure to be a guest on your podcast. For again, thank you. God bless you. And may your journey take you ever upward.
Thank you. Likewise for you.